That's radio. That's talk radio.
This is Haunted America with your host, Josh Mantello, and Al Shepard on Blog Talk Radio. To discuss today's topics, call 646-716-5896. And now, Haunted America with Josh Mantello and Al Shepard.
All right. My name's Al Shepard. I want to say hello to everyone. Hello, Josh.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I hope everybody missed us over our little week's hiatus and is ready back for some more.
Actually, I didn't have a hiatus, but we'll get into that later. I was working for the benefit of the show last weekend.
That is good. I heard that somebody was walking around a ham radio festival with a Haunted America t-shirt on.
Yep, and not only that, I was walking around with a voice recorder and a K2 meter.
Oh, boy, around all those ham radios, you must have been getting some serious K2 fluctuation.
Well, that was my little investigation that I was doing, and I do have an audio clip for that we can get to later whenever we're ready. So, what do you got on the agenda for today?
Well, I know we kind of cut short, and there was a few people that were actually somewhat interested in our paranormal photography conversation, and there was a few pictures left in the queue there, or whatever you want to call it, about that we wanted to kind of cover. We can throw that in whenever, and I know we're kind of on a various topics subject this week, so I figured we could cover a few different things. You already just brought to mind the K2 stuff and the EMF, and I wouldn't mind hitting a little bit on that. That's a great conversation and a great thing for people to really pick up on how to properly, you know, in particular the K2. The K2 is something that it's a newer thing. It's been on all the TV shows, and you see all the celebrity ghost hunters using it, and everybody's grabbing those up like they're going out of style now. So I think that is something that if we could really give them at least a little bit more knowledge about it. This isn't something I planned on talking about, but I think it'd be very knowledgeable subject to really kind of even hit on for 15 minutes here. There's something that kind of came to my mind over the past week, and I have had the exact opposite of you. My past 2 weeks have been straight out. For some people who know me, you've been listening, I've been unemployed, and I kind of have a job on the line, but I gotta get a commercial license to get it, and I've been studying my butt off to get the permit to get on the road and train and then get hired once I get the license. So that ate up my entire week of 5 hours a day cramming in a CDL manual. And thankfully, I passed that on Friday, got that under the bridge, and now I kind of have a book thing I've been cranking out over the past few days because I got a deadline for that. And whew, it's been a busy week.
Yeah, I've actually been right out straight to the point where I haven't even had 5 minutes to go look for a job, so you're still ahead of me. It seems I got so much volunteering that I'm doing that's been taking up all my time. Saturday morning, their local radio station here had a live remote going, and all of a sudden they just disappeared off the air. So definitely technical problems. So I hop in the car and I run down there. It's about 2 minutes away. And I get to the studio, and I sit there for 2 hours helping them keep the show on the road there. But, of course, that was all freebie work. You think I can get a job out of them?
You never know.
Well, not yet, anyway.
We're off subject, but, you know, in the paranormal world, right now everybody's on a slump, whether you're paranormal, whether you're a regular person, you know, not does paranormal, whatever. everybody's kind of in a slump. And I know I've talked to many groups out there. People aren't even looking for investigations. And even to top it all off, you know, I've been studying and I've been, you know, I've been and trying to get this paranormal book picture or paranormal photography book thing done and all this other happy stuff. And what flopped on my, you know, flopped in my email as in the middle of all of it is another case for another investigation. And I'm like, oh, and I got to start preparing for this on top of that. I just now, you know, 3 weeks late wrapped up my last investigation. And another one flops down on the desk. You got to keep yourself busy, and even in this world, it's if you're a paranormal investigator and you don't got work to do, you know, get out there and drum up some business, experiment with your equipment, get out there and have some fun. You know, keep your mind off of it.
Exactly. I mean, every town has cemeteries, and it seems to me, I mean, that's the one place you could probably go and just kind of test out your equipment and without, you know, if you can do it without getting kicked out, you know, and in such a way that you're not too obvious, but you should be able to find a spot to at least train some people or do something, you know.
I know. I got three new people. Hopefully, maybe they're listening. I hope they're listening and learning. I got three new investigators. Only one is trained. Two are still waiting in the wings, and it's hard to get out there. But you bring up a really good subject when you talk about going to cemeteries. Every group has rules and bylaw. It depends on how they're structured. Some groups are just a bunch of friends who go out on the weekends and investigate. And then you got groups that are highly structured, you know, more of, you know, incorporated type groups that, you know, they have bylaws that you have to sign when you join the group and you got to follow or you're kicked out, and very, you know, well organized type of situations. But for rule, but you know, any rule of thumb for anything. And you see it in all these groups. Not all these groups, I can't say that. You see that with a lot of groups now. You see them in a cemetery at night. Or I had to laugh at this one thing. Somebody had showed me a picture, or I came across a picture while surfing the web, and it was, you know, a group going to investigate, and they're going through a gate that just says right in front of them as they cross through the gate, no trespassing, you know, police will be called. You know, at what point do you really have to say, why are you doing that? Why are you going in there? That's, you know, you're putting every one of us, you know, all our names in, you know, bad respect at that. You know, they lump, oh, you're a paranormal investigator. Well, all of you are like that. You know, oh, you're just trying to imitate the people you saw on TV. You know, try and pay attention to that stuff. In cemeteries, I've done it. I've investigated a cemetery at night, but before I did so, I went through in the daylight. I checked the entire grounds, look for at least one sign that said, you know, park closes at dusk, cemetery closes at dusk, you know, do not enter at night. You gotta follow the laws and the rules, because, and it happens. I know there was a newspaper article I came across, you know, ghost hunters arrested for trespassing in old hospital. And that stuff hits, I mean, there's news lines and RSS feeds now that, you know, all for ghost hunting. And these things pop up as soon as it says ghost investigator, ghost hunter, paranormal, anything. And it travels around the country on these feeds and these web pages now dedicated to this stuff. And you're just going to make a bad name for yourself and everybody else around it. It's saying, you know, why are they trespassing? You know, why are they doing that? It doesn't look good. It really doesn't. Battlefield.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, exactly. And spoken with a couple psychics since the last show, and we were talking, and it's, you don't have to go out at night to do an investigation. They told me most of the time when you go into a haunted location and it's nighttime, you're expecting something to happen, so your senses are more alert to it. But if you would get in that same frame of mind and get your senses at their peak, you can go into a cemetery at high noon, or you can walk through a mall or walk down Main Street and possibly catch EVPs or anything like that if you're in tune with it and you're in that frame of mind. You don't need to be breaking into someplace after dark at night just to conduct an investigation.
Absolutely, and this year really kind of strikes me into a conversation and topic that I've lectured on and wrote about on a few occasions. And this is actually one of the topics I kind of wanted to get into, and this is going to transition really well. First, I'm going to hit the why we investigate at night. Everybody said, and there's different theories and different thoughts on the whole process. You can go back to ancient times, pagan witchcraft type of religious backgrounds and things along those lines when, and I'm sure everybody's heard the thing, you know, the veil between the paranormal realm and the earthly realm is thinner or lifted between the hours of 12 midnight and 3 a.m. And then it's really even better, it's lifted completely on Halloween and they can transverse between the two a lot easier. That's all well and good. It's not proven, but it's people have better luck. I investigate at night, or most people, I don't because I'm unemployed, but most people truly investigate at night because they work during the day. Plain and simple. If you work during the day, you can't investigate during the day. If you work at night, well, then maybe you can go out and investigate during the day. I can't claim this saying for myself. I heard it on another, you know, probably the world's largest paranormal talk radio show, Coast to Coast AM. If you've never heard of it, look for it. And if you're up at night, listen to it. It's a great show to learn.
If you've never heard of it, you've been under a rock somewhere.
Yeah, it's true. It's the most listened to radio show overnight. You'll learn a lot. It's great. I can only hope someday we can maybe even hold a remote small candle to it. But anyways, listening to that, I heard an investigator give the perfect reason to why we investigate at night. And it's a flashlight at day, or a flashlight at noon compared to a flashlight at midnight. Now, imagine you're holding a flashlight, just your regular, any flashlight. It's high noon on a sunny day, and you shine that flashlight. What do you see of that light?
Yeah, not much.
None. You shine that flashlight on a wall at high noon, you're not going to see much at all. Take that same flashlight with the same bulb, the same exact flashlight, at midnight, outside, anywhere in the dark. You shine that flashlight on the wall, what do you see?
All kinds of stuff, yeah.
It's light.
Yeah.
It's brighter. It might even hurt your eyes, you know, where now during the day it doesn't. So now we're considering spirits. We're looking for a spirit and we are out. And now this spirit needs to manifest itself somehow. And this spirit, by manifesting itself, is going to create an apparition or an orb or anything. It's light. It's going to be visible light to manifest to a visible state. So if we're investigating in the daylight, and the spirit is manifesting through the purpose of light, and it's noontime, you probably can't see that light that it's emanating and using to manifest itself nowhere near as clearly during the day than you would if you were investigating at night. There is a truly good scientific, logical explanation as to why we investigate at night. You know, but again, you can go and you can. There's no reason that it still can't emanate and create EVPs, EMF fluctuations, some sort of video, or even, you know, maybe if it's a strong enough spirit or has enough energy to really manifest itself, create a full body apparition during the day. How many people have been to Gettysburg and have seen, you know, spirits walking around in the battlefields when it was daylight? Plenty. But if that spirit was really walking around at night and it was emanating some sort of light, we'd see it a whole lot better at night. There is really our true reason behind investigating at night and not trespassing in the cemeteries.
Well, a gentleman in the chat room says about the same thing I've said on previous shows, is most people have their experiences during normal waking hours, during the daytime. So why wouldn't that be the time you'd hunt for them?
Or
do you think things are going on while they're sleeping they're just not aware of?
You got to take that into consideration. When is your most conscious time that you're awake and able to experience something? Is during the daytime. the majority of the overnight hours, especially the hours that we investigate. When I investigate, we don't even really get rolling till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night is when we really get rolling and doing some hardcore, getting our hands dirty investigating. At that point, most people are winding down and going to sleep, unless you're a night person. So, kind of by the law of percentages, the law of averages, your experiences are going to be during the earlier daylight hours, because that is a time when you're awake, you're conscious, your senses are more heightened. As the night goes on, your senses are going down, you're unwinding, you're not as alert and aware of your situation and what's around you. You might not see things. But I'm not trying to say what he is saying is wrong by any means, because he's absolutely right. If you do have more occurrences during the day, by all means, there's no reason to say you can't investigate during the day. Go to a cemetery in the middle of the morning or the middle of the afternoon after dinner time and walk around. Yeah, you might get some more noise pollution, but deal with it. It's all about getting out there, and this is really going to kind of bring into a topic that has been kind of close to me. For those of you who have ever been on my MySpace and looked at my blog, I don't post it often, maybe once a year, but I have one on there called Quality, Not Quantity Investigations. And that really kind of hits right onto the subject of going anywhere you can in the middle of the night, including cemeteries and abandoned, properties you don't have permission to be at just to investigate.
Okay. Sitting here typing away in the chat room here. I'm trying to think how to follow this up. Because I've always been the believer that spirits are all around us at all times, and you don't need to go to a haunted house just to find one, And,
all right.
I got a little 2-minute clip here. Let me play this for you. I watched a movie over the weekend called Your Worst Nightmare: Supernatural Assault. It was about sleep paralysis and things like that, which was right down the line of the out of body experiences and stuff I've been researching the last few weeks. And movies put out by Soul Smack Productions out of Maine, soulsmack.com. And these two people here made a lot of sense on what they said, so I wanted to save this clip and just play it for you and get your opinion on what they had to say here.
The idea of a different dimension, domain, whatever, would suggest that it is a different place in the same place, sort of. As opposed to these being things that are, for example, you mentioned the narrow range of the visible spectra. Well, if there were something in your environment that had a color that was outside of our visual range and it stood in front of you, it wouldn't be invisible. It would just look black. It would block out the light from behind and it would reflect light that you couldn't see. So it would just look dark. It would look like a shadow.
Very interesting.
That's a good point, isn't it? Yeah, well, maybe there's something to that.
Science says if it's not in accordance with our laws, it doesn't exist. Oh, but by the way, 95% of the material that's out there, we know nothing about except that it's there. Right, so science in its own mind has limits. We're looking into possibly establishing that it's okay to believe in other dimensions, and now we're getting, you and your spirit guides' response to that.
Well, they're saying science. Where does science come from?
It comes from measurement, the human experience, right?
They're saying man. Therefore, limited. It's coming from man, therefore it's going to be limited, they're saying. There's a whole nother world, like we like to say, they're saying, out there. It will never be understood by man. It's not meant to be. that is for another, they're saying time, another dimension. It's when we pass through this life and we get to the other side, we might now know something else entirely, totally foreign to what we were used to hear.
All right, two things. One, if this dimension is always there at all times and we just can't see it, and we discussed this a little bit the last time we talked about paranormal photography, if they are just outside of our visible range, and sometimes they happen to pop into our visible range, and that's why you can see ghosts now and then. The gentleman was talking about the shadow people just being something of a color that we can't visibly see, therefore we only see them as shadows. Wouldn't we be able to see a shadow person better in the daytime than at night?
This is that's a very good theory. And I would have to say it would depend on the actual situation and the light we have. Is it a bright day or is it a dim day, cloudy day? The sun is very bright. So in a very well-lit situation, the light that is being created that we can see might be overpowering of it, is my initial thought. Honestly, that's the first time I've really ever heard that theory, and it's a very smart theory, and it sounds really great. But I'm almost, at the same time, I'm kind of thinking that if we're outside and it's such a very bright, sunny day, we're in a very well-lit room, the ambient light of that room might just actually be too bright to be, it'll overpower the light that's being emanated that we can't see. But I can absolutely see where the shadow person will become seen in a dark situation where we're using a very low level light, and because I've had it happen a million times. I have seen a shadow figure form right in front of me on a couple of occasions, and I've had a few interactions with shadow figures before, and both of them are in not complete dark situations. Or I was in a completely dark area looking towards a very dimly lit area, and I can see where maybe that dim light wasn't enough to overpower that light, and then the shadow was formed. That's a very good theory. I've never heard of that, and I just thought I might have to look into it a little bit more as it goes. But I would think that theory works very well in low light situations where I think maybe in daytime the sun or a well-lit room would actually overpower the light that we can't see to the point where it wouldn't create a dark figure in front of us.
Yeah, that was the first time I'd heard that theory too, but it did make sense to me is maybe there's more colors out there than what we can visibly see, and if this thing happens to be that color, then all you're going to see is black, the absence of color. So I don't know, I guess there's a kind of a fine line here, because if you're looking for glowing orbs or something like that, then I'd say yeah, you want it dark. But in my thought, if you're looking for a black shadow, then you don't want a black room. But yet what you say is if there's too much light, you might not see it at all. That also makes sense to me. So I'm not sure which way to go, but then maybe that's what the second person on the clip was talking about.
Well,
we are not meant to understand it in this lifetime. We're not going to get the answers we're searching for until we get there.
And I think it depends on what's creating that. If you're in a situation and it's bright out and it is purely a black mass, a absence of light, not according to what they're saying, is what this black mass is a light that we can't see, but it's still blocking the ambient light we can see, hence creating what looks black. Or a shadow.
Right. It still has mass. It's still there, so it would block out what's behind it. But yet, it's just a color we can't see, therefore it automatically is going to look black.
Now, if this was truly a black mass, not a, a color that we can't see, but truly just a black mass, yeah, that would be visible at any time, except for when you're in pitch black. It would be extremely visible in a high light situation, you know, during
but
the
I don't
day.
Think there's a, I don't think there's any such thing as pitch black. I mean, even in the darkest night, it's a grayish. It's not a complete black, unless maybe if you're underground in a cave somewhere, you know, where there's absolutely no visible light. I've been down to Howl's Caverns down in there, and when they turn out the light, that is pitch black, and that's about the only time I've ever seen pitch black.
Right, and that's true too. It is going to be a tough time to really try and find a purely pitch black situation. I've investigated in some very dark places with no electricity in rooms, and still there is always, especially now in modern times, if you're anywhere near a city or you got somewhat of a moon out, there's street lights coming in, there's always a little bit of light somewhere coming along.
Exactly. And see, I can't multitask worth a crap anymore. I can't type and talk. There's always some light coming from somewhere, no matter how minute it is. Because you'll notice, I mean, even in your house at night, you get up in the middle of the night, you can't see nothing. You just give it 10 minutes for your eyes to adjust, and you can make out things in your house. And gentleman in the chat room is asking where I'm from. Yeah, Josh is from North Adams, Massachusetts. I'm from Benton, Vermont. And Michael Jackson's ghost is from upstate New York. Wow, I didn't even know he was there. Man, I've seen so much of that on TV the last week, I had turned TV off.
I feel like I'd be in haunted by him lately.
So,
every time I turn on the TV, I'm haunted by it.
That and commercials. Okay, now I forgot where I was headed with this train of thought here. Oh, well.
Okay.
So, anyway, basically the reason most people haunt at night is because they have day jobs. So if more investigative groups got paid money to do this, they could probably afford to do it during the day, huh?
I don't think, though, at the same time, I really don't think we would want to completely abandon the thought of going at night, because I really have come to adopt the flashlight at day versus the flashlight at night theory. That, you know, these spirits may be weak, they may not be able to manifest enough light. Because it really is. Our EVPs are great, you know, EMF fluctuations are great, temperature, that stuff's all great and well and fine, and that's all great evidence. But our true holy grail of ghost hunting and investigating the paranormal is capturing a full body apparition. It's what everybody wants and everybody's trying to get. And I really honestly think your best bet of doing that would be in the dark, in a dark situation, because of the fact that it's going to be that light that the spirit is emanating, because it's not going to be a solid mass. Some people adopted the theory, you know, when a spirit manifests, it creates ectoplasm, which, you know, it's not just something from Ghostbusters. It's a true thing, ectoplasm. You know, these apparitions might just be a kind of a plasm, but basically it's light. So we want a darker situation to be able to allow them to be more easily seen if they are not able to manifest up enough energy to really make something a body apparition visible in the daylight hours. I think, you know, we wouldn't ever want to fully abandon night investigating. And night investigating also allows us to use infrared night vision, which is another reason, you know, we were talking about how... Oh, go ahead, Al.
No, well, that was the question I was going to ask earlier. If you had a camera that blocked out all visible light and only shot in the infrared, then it shouldn't make a difference whether it's daylight or nighttime, right?
That is true. That, yeah, that's absolutely true. Unfortunately, most people really can't afford those cameras or video cameras. It's possible. Sony had one on the market for a while where you could buy infrared filters, but they really turned into the teenage boy's most fascinating, wonderful X-ray vision toy because infrared will go through certain fabrics, and you point that camera at somebody during the day, it goes right through clothes, and they had to discontinue the infrared filters. But,
now
you just made
me want to go buy one.
But basically, that clip you played, you know, they mentioned how, you know, this might be light that's not visible to us. Well, that's infrared light. There's a lot of people who really truly believe that spirits are in the infrared realm or they're emitting infrared light. It has a lot to do with infrared. And unfortunately, without using these filters or getting the more expensive cameras, you gotta investigate at night to really use infrared really well, especially. I don't work for Sony, but their cameras are top notch for the night vision stuff because those are the infrared cameras. You get the Hi-8 mini DVs or the Sony Handycams with night shot that runs off infrared.
Night shot, yep.
I've seen a lot of investigators make the mistake of going out and not going with the Sony. And there's other companies that make the night vision cameras using infrared, but make sure it uses infrared for night vision. I made this mistake myself as an investigator. A very first investigation, I had another handheld camcorder that had a night vision mode, and basically that used a version of sampling where it would more or less just take a picture every second and then turn that into video. So everything that went by it streaked and looked like a flying orb or some weird ghost. You know, with the Sony versions with the night shot, and now they got the super night shot, it's using the infrared light. It's only reading the infrared light. And then when you have regular ambient light, it also reads that. So you almost get somewhat of a color picture. But in a pure dark situation, you can't see anything coming out of the camera, but it's filling the room with infrared light. We went out and bought a few extra emitters or infrared, like flashlight type of devices. Yeah, fill the room with light that you can't see, and it works great. And that's really kind of another reason why we work at night, is it allows you to use that infrared technology to maybe try and look into this other realm where they might be emanating that bit of light that we can't see.
But in theory, say you had unlimited bank account, and you could buy a purely infrared camera, then that should be able to pick up the same thing at high noon as it would at 3 a.m., correct?
That's right. That's absolutely true. Because there's ambient infrared light, too. There's nothing saying, there's infrared light, I'm sure, floating around my living room right now as I'm doing this radio show. I just can't see it. The sun emits it, your neon bulbs emit it. You just can't see it. It's there. And it reacts no different than normal light. It's like any other light wave. It bounces off mirrors and, it does weird things with lenses sometimes. You got to take all that into consideration when you're using that, just like you would any other video or picture, because it's still just light, and it reacts the same way as any other light. You just got to remember that it's just light that you can't see, and you kind of have to think outside the box and treat it like regular light before you really start jumping to a lot of real quick conclusions with it.
Okay, now you just mentioned the lights that's coming from the sun. That just made me think back to when I took my ham radio test, and they taught us that, I don't know about the veil between worlds, but the atmosphere is thinner at nighttime. During the day, you have what they call the D, E, F1, and F2 layers in the atmosphere. And at night, I believe it's the D layer disappears, and the F1 and F2 combine together to make the F layer. So, theoretically, at nighttime, I know the sun's on the other side of the world, but whatever happens to be floating around out there would be able to get through easier at nighttime than it would during the daytime, as far as stray light coming from the sun or planets or wherever the heck. I don't know much about astrology or any astronomy, so I don't know just what, but I'm just the thought popped into my head here that you might get stray things from outer space or out of the atmosphere that will come through at night that wouldn't come through in the daytime. Which may be good or bad as far as an investigation goes.
And that's true. That kind of brings up a good topic or a good quick little side note on all this is a lot of investigators do monitor the sun and its activities prior to an investigation. I do, and I always make a note of it when I do my investigation report, that whether there or not there was a solar flare, whether they're sunspots, there are people who believe when the Earth enters a solar stream or when there's a lot of flare activity going on, that there is an increase in paranormal activity. I've never really seen any true documentation comparing the two, but you know, I document it anyways, and I haven't really seen much, but I haven't really investigated yet when there has been a lot of solar activity. And basically, I think the main theory behind it is the Earth enters a solar stream, it's electrifying the atmosphere, basically. You see the northern lights, that's a chemical, electrical reaction in the atmosphere from the tiny solar particles smacking against the atmosphere and creating this situation. It's just like an electrical storm. People feel, when you have electrical storms in the area and thunderstorms, that paranormal activity may increase. And that all boils down to spirits needing ambient electricity or energy to help manifest themselves. So, now, I mean, this is a theory that has, has even spawned, it's a free download, anybody who investigates it, they should get it, is called the Ghost Weather Station. It's a quick little download for your desktop. You hit it, and it tells you the moon phase. That's another thing people, always kind of document the moon phase. People feel sometimes during different moon phases are better to investigate than others, but also will give you if there's a lot of solar x-rays and solar flares going on, whether they're normal, above normal, or extreme, and document it. So this is obviously a theory that's warranted enough for somebody to go out and write a program for your desktop, to go after. I personally, like I said, I haven't seen any true documentation comparing the two, whether, there is an increase in paranormal activity during that, but you never know. Maybe if we all did it, we could actually go through everybody's notes and find out whether it is true or not.
Okay. Oh yeah, I'm here. We were just chatting in the chat room here, and someone touched a nerve that I'm familiar with here. So I was just kind of chatting back with them here. Let's see. I don't know about the. Of course, nobody knows. That's what we've always said. I mean, this is what's so great about being in this. This subject right now, this beginning of this science of ghost investigations, is nobody knows what's relevant or what isn't, and what's right and what's wrong, and that's what's exciting to me, is going down this path trying to figure out what doesn't work, what does, what patterns are going to develop as time goes on, is it. There are always more hauntings at a full moon or a new moon or anything like that,
And that's true. And I think as we get going, and I know we mentioned it briefly with Michael Baker when he was on the show with us, he's creating that internet database of investigators to put the reports and stuff like that. That's what's really needed, because up until now, nothing like that has been available. And it's really just been thoughts and theories and word of mouth whether or not people have had better experiences during A situation, B situation, or C situation. If we had a commutative database where we can pull up and say, okay, where is everybody's reports or everybody's investigation from July 5th on such and such a date when there was X amount of solar flares, X amount of solar activity, X amount of thunderstorms in the atmosphere, and, you know, we're able to create a percentage and say there was an 80% hit or an 80% amount of solar or paranormal activity documented on that such day. And then we can go, okay, on July 30th of that same year, there was no solar flare, nothing. We were at the same investigations, and we only found 40% evidence. At that point, we can actually start creating and getting that together and pulling all this together and say, okay, that's how science is formed. That's how these theories are worked, and this is how we can actually get it out there and start saying, okay, instead of saying we think that during this time we can capture ghosts easier, we can say we know, because look, go to this webpage or go to this database and say, here you are, on this day when all this was happening, we had an increase of paranormal activity that was documented and captured by X group, B group, and C group, you know, and then the same thing on this day when there wasn't here, this group and this group and this group were at the same place, but they caught a lot less.
Then you just got to figure out where to go look once you figured out when.
And that's true. And you're absolutely right. And one of the things I really wanted to talk about tonight is quality investigation instead of quantity investigation. I've blogged about it. I've spoke on it. I try and get it out there. And this is, I think, kind of the pitfall. And it even kind of gets into going to your cemeteries, you know, in the middle of the night just for the sake of going there. Is, yeah, you're a new group, you're a new investigator, and you want to hunt ghosts and you want to get your name out there. You're feeling great and excited about yourself, and you want to go out and you want to investigate everything you humanly possibly can. You know, that's great. You're a go-getter, you want to do it, but be careful and make sure you're doing it properly. Yeah, I can't count how many different groups, web pages I've been to or groups I've talked to say, oh, what have you done lately? Oh, we've done 6 investigations this month. 6. If I do 6 a year, I'm lucky. And where'd you go? Well, I went to A cemetery, B cemetery, this closed down building, you know, this person's this. I go, what'd you find? You know, they're going out there, they're rushing it, they're doing it quickly, just so that they can get back to their web page, post a bunch of pictures of them walking around with their equipment, so that somebody else can jump onto their webpage and say, oh my God, they've investigated a million places. They must be good. I'm going to have them do my house. I really don't feel that's the way it should work. Just because you've been to a lot of haunted places and walked around in the dark with your flashlights and a K2 meter in your hand does not mean you've investigated. All that means is you've been and looked into a haunted place. I think there's a very big difference between actually truly investigating and going out and just walking around in the dark with all your buddies holding a K2 meter and a flashlight in your hand.
So what you're saying is when I went out with my recorder and my K2 meter last weekend, I was not really investigating, huh?
Now, it doesn't mean what you're doing is wrong. I think, let me pull it up. I got to look at it here real quick. The true definition of investigating. I got it right here saved somewhere, but there's nothing wrong with it. As long as where you're going, you're legally allowed to go there, that's fine. You know, you have permission to be where you are. You're not going to get arrested for trespassing. That's great. You know, go out there. It gets your feet wet. And you're learning how to handle your equipment in the dark, and that all works real well. Let's see. The definition
now,
of
how much of it is learning not to be afraid of the dark as the first step?
Well, that's a lot. It's to not jump at every little creak in the board. To learn how to walk. Just walking around in the dark is a completely different thing than just walking around during the day. You got to walk a lot slower. If you walk around at the speed that you walk around during the day, when you walk around at night, you're going to walk into something and hurt your face. Yeah, you got to walk slower. You got to learn how to be more observant. Use all your senses. Listen, feel, smell, you know, take your time. Be observant. Observe everything around you at all times. And again, don't be afraid. Some people might know this, but don't do a dude run. So when you hear something, don't just freak out and run away as fast as you can, because what just happened is what you're looking for. If, you know, my God, there's a ghost, run away.
Now, what'd you say? Don't do a what?
You know, a dude run. You know, you ever hear, see the dude run?
Dude run!
There you go. Do a dude run. Don't do a dude run. You know, you don't want to do that. You kind of have to have nerves of steel. I've been in plenty of situations where something has happened and the person next to me has freaked out. You know, either I've given a tour or a training session or whatever, and they have to get right out, and you just got to stay put. You got to get it set in your mind that this is not going to hurt you. You're going to be okay. This is what you came out to do. You came out and walked around this haunted, dark building for the purpose of experiencing it. Why else would you have gone out? So when it starts happening, don't turn away and run from it. Stand there and experience it. Videotape it. Take its pictures. Smell it. Feel it. Do what you got to do. But, you know, look,
it's like
I found what I was
looking for. The first time I started working at a service station, having to deal with the hundreds of people that walk in there every day, complete strangers, and you have to talk to them. I mean, I can remember I was scared crapless the first day on the job, and now I'm to the point where I can walk up to a complete stranger on the street and talk to them and not bother me at all. And that's basically the same thing what you're saying. You know, you just got to get out there and get over it, and before you know it, a few years are going to go by, and you're going to look back and laugh at yourself.
Well, that... Still there, Al? Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right, I just got a message.
Hello? Saying you're what?
I just said I was off the host queue. I don't know if I got booted out. If you're in the chat room, if you can still hear me, just let me know, and we'll... Pretend that never happened.
You're on.
All right. The Blog Talk Radio lady just told me I was out of the queue. All right. As long as you can still hear me, we'll keep going. But anyways, as I was saying, I found what I was looking for. Now, this is from Merriam-Webster's Dictionary. To investigate is to observe or study by close examination and systematic inquiry. Now, walking around in a cemetery with a radio, are you systematically inquiring by close examination, studying the paranormal? No. You're out, you're learning, you're training, it serves a purpose, and I'm not bashing, you know, doing that by any means, because I still do that. There's times when I just grab one particular piece of equipment, go to my haunted building, and just do that. That is part of my continual research of particular hauntings. But am I investigating that night? No. So I think that you need to keep in mind what investigating is. Again, it is to observe or study by close examination and systematic inquiry. So to study the paranormal, you know, have a close examination with a systematic inquiry. In other words, you're going in with a plan. You have a system set, you know, of what you want to do and how you want to do it, and you're going to go about doing it that way. When you're just in, there's nothing wrong with it. I've gone out with my recorder to a cemetery and just to have some fun and do it. And you'll serve a purpose and you might capture some evidence. But my grudge are the people who are just doing that. They're going out with their buddies to have some fun in their newly formed group and saying that they are hardcore seasoned investigators because they've gone out with just, you know, a handful of things in a cemetery, you know, six times that we've investigated. We've done 50 investigations this year. Did you really investigate 50 times this year, or did you just kind of go out and play around with your equipment and train? You know, I really feel that some of your best groups are the groups that aren't out there every weekend doing this, because some of your best groups are the groups that may only have six or seven people in it, they don't have every weekend free and available to go out and investigate. And when they go out and when they do go out, they are said, okay, we only get 5 investigations a year. Let's make each one truly worth it. And then if you're investigating every weekend, how closely are you really paying attention to the evidence you've gathered, especially if you're only a 4 or 5 person group? You know, you go out Saturday night, you're going to look through, you know, 5 to 8 to 10 hours of video, you know, a couple hours of audio, hundreds of pictures, write a report, you know, think about what you've done and how it happened in a week's time before you start even preparing for your next one the following Saturday. We need good quality investigations, not the quantity of them. I'm a firm believer of once you have a good investigation, don't just leave them hanging on the hook, because we're not going to find true documented paranormal recurring activity by going to a haunting just once. You need to go back. You need to be, you know, you need to research at this point. Investigation and research. You know, you had a haunting and you found activity. Go back a month later. Try and get that activity again and again and again. You know, and at that point, you're going to start learning what was happening a little bit more. What conditions led to your activity? You're gonna be able to either anticipate it, you know, say, all right, I remember when I was here 2 months ago, I had the same feeling and I had these same readings on my meter, and now I think something's gonna happen. Well, now you're learning that, and you're documenting, and you can might be able to start proving that during certain situations, certain paranormal activity happens at certain spots, and this is gonna be a lot more useful to investigators, and you know, not just yourself, but the investigative community, if you're able to document it through continual research of just one haunting, then going to a dozen different hauntings a year, you know, each one being a little different.
All right, that you pretty much you saved me. When you said if you're going in somewhere with a plan and a strategy, then that might be a valid investigation. So therefore, what I did last weekend might qualify as a valid investigation.
Right.
What's your thought on stray radio waves and EVPs and K2 meters? Well, what's your feelings on stray radio waves triggering K2s and causing EVPs? Because I know I've heard some people say that what you captured on the EVP is just a stray radio wave.
Well, and that's absolutely true. It sounds like you had a phone call or something. That's absolutely true. Stray radio waves, they're two separate things here, for one thing. Stray radio waves and radio signals and ambient power sources absolutely affect your K2s and any EMF meter. K2s are just a lot more sensitive to them. Boy, with EVP, I have a real hard time with it. I think it's absolutely plausible and has, will, and can happen. Get an EVP via a stray radio signal. Well, how about, I really don't want to use the word stray radio signal to cause the EVP. I feel you need to have a very powerful transmitter somewhere near your recorder when you make that EVP to get that to happen. I mean, you're into radio and you know a lot better than I do. You know.
Well, I didn't really know for sure until I went out last weekend and found out, you know, answered some questions for myself too. So.
Yeah, and it's true, and it does happen. It really does, and I think you need to have a very powerful radio signal. And you gotta. My biggest thing is you gotta take into consideration what your question was, what you asked, or what the conversation was at the time, and then when you get your response. Now, if you say that, you know, are you here with us, Spirit of Joe Smith? And you get a response of Car 32, can you respond to this street for a domestic assault? really think, you know, that isn't your EVP. That is a, you, maybe you're near the police transmitter. Maybe a police cruiser drove by you and you got your response. If you say, okay, spirit of Joe Smith, are you here with me today? And you get a response, yes, I'm Joe Smith. I want to communicate with you. You know, what radio signal is that? And how is it really causing that? You know, I think you kind of have to take into consideration what it is. And yeah, maybe sometimes these EVPs, some of these short, quick little one-word EVPs that you do capture, you know, sometimes people get, you know, an EVP, are you here with us? And you just get a yes or a no or a maybe, you know, a quick little one-word answers. You know, that's a very strong chance that that EVP is being caused by a stray radio signal. So,
well, with your permission here, I will play a little clip here of what I found out last weekend, and we can get your opinion after it.
All right.
Privacy and news, November Whiskey Golf.
Hello, everyone. This is Al, and I am here in the middle of a field at Amateur Radio Field Day. For those of you who don't know what that is, it's an emergency preparedness exercise that ham radio operators do every year. I'm here to test a theory. I've heard a lot of people say that EVPs are simply stray radio signals. So I'm here in the middle of this field, about 100 feet away in all four directions, are towers with huge antennas on top, connected to radios, putting out about 100 watts apiece. I've been doing a little experimenting with a K2 meter. With all this transmitting going on here and all these radio frequencies in the air, I figured I'd test that theory. When they're actually transmitting on the air, it does make the K2 flicker. Actually, right here, I'm 100 feet away, and I'm getting a little in one direction, which is the frequency. They're down about 3.5 megahertz. That station's running at. The one running at 7 megahertz is not affecting. Okay, it's flickering just one little light. The one running 14 megahertz does not appear to be affecting it at all. And the one running at 28 megahertz is flickering just this is the second green light's just flickering a little bit. So normally, you don't have radios running around running this much power. Your average police department vehicle runs about 25 watts. CBs run 4, and your little handheld family-type radios are running around 5 or so. So what we've got here is stations running about 4 times what you'd normally find in your average everyday neighborhood. So I think I've pretty much laid to rest. In order to get a full-scale signal on the K2, you'd have to be right on top of it. So as long as you have your handy talkies turned off during an investigation, I don't think there's much chance of you catching anything from outdoors. All right, another reason why I'm recording here is I want to see if any of the transmitting being done is going to wind up imprinting itself on this digital recorder. So I'm going to take a walk around the area here and get up close to the stations and see if we wind up with any strange EVPs, I guess you'd call them. So we're walking over here. If I don't get beheaded by this guy wire, over here standing outside of what's called the 40 meter station. Okay, you can probably hear him, his voice coming out through the door. So, all right, now I'm past the door, right almost directly under their antenna. And now I'm going to head over here to what's called the 20 meter station. Alright, I'm right underneath the 20 meter tower, and we'll see what we get there.
pick up anything strange on here.
And the K2 is flickering as I get nearer to the stations, which is to be expected. I'll head back over here toward the 10-meter tower. All right, I'm right underneath the 10-meter tower, and it's almost full scale on the K2 when they start transmitting. All right, we're going to take a listen and see what we've caught.
Now, during my little walk around here, it was quite obvious to me that you had to stand right under the antenna putting out 100 watts in order for the K2 meter to register full scale. So that pretty much to me lays the theory to rest that outside radio interference is not going to trigger a K2 meter inside a building. It would have to be somebody pretty much right in the same room with you. Also, while reviewing this tape, as you can tell, I edited out a lot of it, the walking around part, and my heavy breathing. I did not catch any EVPs. Everything that was on the tape was what I heard physically with my ears. Now, I know we had Michael Baker on a few weeks back, and he did figure out a way in a lab to send a voice across a room and imprint it on a digital recorder without anyone hearing it. But using a standard radio could not make that happen. So I think we're back to what he was saying, is these are showing up on the digital recorders by ways that we do not understand currently. So rest assured, when you are out getting your EVPs or getting hits on your K2 meter, they're not coming from outside radio sources. And this is Al, doing his best on-location reporter-type impersonation. And now back to you, Josh, in the studio.
Wow. My living room is the studio. That was great. But, you know, it takes that. Now, that you're right. That is investigating, you know. That's research. And I think that's what we need more of. We need more investigation and research into the field than just hundreds of groups popping up a year, just running out to any investigation they can and doing God knows what. Just walking around the building in the dark with flashlights, waiting for something to happen, and calling it an investigation. That was investigating. Now, sure, you weren't, you know, using, or you know, I would maybe not so much calling investigating, but researching. Where's the research? Where, you know, everybody wants to call themselves ghost hunters or paranormal investigators. Nope, you don't hear anybody ever saying I'm a paranormal researcher. That was research. That served a purpose, and that's great. You know, and the K2 stuff, that's very true. There's you know, a wide variety of EMF meters on the market in which the K2 is one of them. They all are tuned to different levels of radiation, to different frequencies of radiation, EMF radiation, and different sensitivities. The K2 is very sensitive. It really is. I've been in a room, you know, using a K2 and didn't shut my cell phone off. And when that cell phone every now and then searches for a signal, it's going to flicker. If you get a text message, you know, when that text message comes in, you're going to see it flicker a couple times. You know, that real high frequency cell phone signal. But again, that is in the same room. I've been in the rooms using a K2, and, you know, a lot of people investigate. They carry little two-way, you know, the Walmart brand, Radio Shack brand two-way walkie-talkies. You know, when they use those, the K2s will trigger quite high. But again, like you said, you know, in the room, a power source or radio signal from 100 feet away outside that building isn't going to really trigger it to a point where, you know, you're using that to communicate. That worked out really well. You just got to remember, don't use your radio and shut your cell phone off. And then you should be pretty good to go. And you're getting a high reading that doesn't belong, that's not attached to an electrical source. And there, you got something. There you go. You know, you served the purpose there.
I usually go out there once a year, and I do field day. It's about the only ham radio I do anymore. And I just got thinking of you know, the amount of EMF that was swirling around in that field out there, what better place to test? And I had no idea what I was going to find. I mean, it, as far as I know, it might have totally backed up the theory that, yeah, these things are setting them off from a mile and a half away, you know, but I didn't find
that. And there's nothing wrong with that. If you found out that these things are setting them off from a half a mile away, that is great. You just served an immense purpose. You know, because, you know what, if you're investigating somewhere in a city, I can guarantee I could probably find some sort of transmitter within a half a mile. You know, whether it be your fire department, police department, ambulance, you know, hospital, taxi cab company, something. You know, there's transmitters all over the place. There really are. A guy down the road using a CB, a guy down the road using a ham. You know,
exactly. I was just going to say, when you're doing your research of the neighborhood, look up and see if you see antennas on someone's houses, because ham radio operators can legally run on certain bands up to 2,000 watts. So, I mean, they theoretically could be putting out, 20 times what I was experiencing there in the field. So if you take the 100 foot that I was from them, and you're talking 2,000 feet. So I mean you're up there half a mile away if they're running full scale legal limit. So
absolutely,
something to keep in mind when you're researching the neighborhood and stuff.
It kind of reminisces me back to a investigation I conducted, where I was having a situation where I came to the conclusion we were communicating with a spirit via EMF. And it all started using the theory of what we've all seen on TV with people using the K2s to communicate basically with a digital dialing form. And you ask a question, and from that question, you know, whether it being a yes answer, no answer, or whatever, the response comes out over the K2 meter. So we started this, but we said, why limit ourselves to the K2s and utilize every bit of our EMF that we have? And it started basically is while investigating and doing our baseline and sweep of the building, we kept getting a random EMF spike on the stairwell of this building. Now, this is a mid-1800s building, built by a major of the Revolutionary War, friend of George Washington, you know, blah, blah. It had some history behind it, and the clients had a pretty good story about the haunting, too. So we couldn't really find an explanation for this random EMF spike occurring on the stairs. So we started by taking an EMF cell sensor, which uses a remote probe, to measure with, and we just set it on the stairs. And what this does is actually has like a flashing red light and alarm that triggers whenever the EMF spikes above 2 milligauss. And we just placed that on the stairs with the probe kind of hanging over the railing, and sure enough, just randomly throughout the night, we would get this spike. So around midnight, this was the only thing happening. We kind of encircled the stairs, me sitting on the top holding I had a digital voice recorder with a more high-end digital EMF meter. We had another person at the bottom of the stairs with a cell sensor. I had a K2 on the stairs. We had one person using a tri-field meter. We had the entire basis of EMF meters covered on this, and we started asking our questions. And, you know, are you here with us? And the guy, the spirit was supposedly named Butler Goodrich. Are you here with us, Butler? And sure enough, it spiked. You know, whenever we asked a question that we knew to be true, we would be getting amazing spikes. And even at some of the occurrences, I got a spike, I would get an EVP at the same time. And, you know, a few of my team members are ham operators also. And so we figured, all right, we were within probably about 3/4 mile range of Berkshire Medical Center. You know, and I would imagine that they have quite a powerful transmitter on the top of that, hospital for ambulance call-ins, helicopter call-ins, whatever. So we said, we got to rule this out. One of our guys actually had one of his portable radios with him. He turned it on. He transmitted within an extremely close proximity of this meter and was not even measuring remotely as close as high as it was on its own without the transmission. So if we basically came to the conclusion as if this handheld ham can't spike it as high, you know, within a couple feet of this meter, there's no way if they're 3/4 of a mile away can spike them that high, let alone the fact that I was getting an EVP at the same time, which obviously I found out afterwards, and that these spikes were, coming in concurrence with actual questions. You know, were you a major in the Revolutionary War? It spiked. And then, it really came to head with a great experience for all of us. It was amazing. I got it on audio. I wish I had it on video. We started asking questions of the spirit about killing people in the war. You know, did you kill people in the war? Did you kill your friends? Blah, blah, blah. And the, as we were talking about killing and death in the war, the readings on these meters became higher and higher and more intense, to the point where all of a sudden I hear a crash and a bang from the bottom of the stairs. And one of my investigators just flat out goes, "I didn't do it." And I'm like, "What was that?" He goes, "My EMF meter just went flying off the table and crashed to the ground on its own." So all this put together, we said, this isn't straight radio waves knocking these things up, throwing things off the ground and imprinting EVP. This was some sort of spirit activity.
Yeah, no, another thing that came to my mind when you said he had a handheld is to just tune it to that frequency and listen for when the medical center started speaking and see if that corresponded with flu. That would have been another way to do it as well. You are listening to Haunted America Radio. Before I forget, next Sunday, second hour, we're going to have Dave Schrader as a guest. If you don't know Dave, he is the host of Darkness on the Edge of Town, Paranormal, can't even talk, radio. I believe he's based out of Minnesota, and he's been doing this a couple of years, so he's going to come over here, and we're going to show him how amateurs do it, and he'll feel so much better about himself after he leaves.
Darkness Dave, yeah, he's got a pretty good name for himself out there on the paranormal radio internet circuit, I guess.
Yep, he does. He used to be Dave and Tim, and I guess budget cuts laid Tim off. No, first time I've ever heard of someone laying off a co-host of a radio show, but oh well. If they did it for free like we do, then they wouldn't have that problem.
All right. I guess if we had a budget, we'd have to worry about it.
All right. What else you got up your sleeve over there?
I've hit pretty much quite a few. I know there was something else I wanted out in there, and I got going on so much other topics, and I can't believe we've already made it through an hour and 15 minutes here. I think we got time to go over those few more pictures you wanted to go over. I definitely wanted to wrap that up.
Yeah, we've only got about 10 more pictures to touch on. We went through a lot of them the last time. For those of you who weren't here, 3 weeks ago we started to did a show on paranormal photography, and Josh was going through some photos one by one and telling me his feelings on them, if he thought they were real or not, and we kind of ran out of time, so we still got about 10 photos left here to go through. So let me post the link over to those so any of you listening can jump over there and join in on the conversation. The first photo we need to talk with, it should say file 26 of 35. Is what it should say at the top. It's the picture is called Faces in the Waves, And I'm going to bring up the history behind these pictures here as well, so you know a little bit of the story behind it. If I can get it up here. Are you you on the page with me, Josh, or
So those are supposed to be waves, huh?
Down. Get people to make more sense to you. And I hope everyone else in the chat room is able to jump over there. Okay. Story behind this, it's been floating around the internet for years. Let's see. In 1924, James Courtney and Michael Meehan were two crewmen of the tanker, the SS Watertown. They were accidentally killed by gas fumes while cleaning a cargo tank. The crew of the Watertown, on its way to the Panama Canal from New York City, buried the two sailors at sea off the Mexican coast. That was on December 4th. On December 5th, the first mate reported that the faces of Courtney and Meehan were appearing in the water off the port side of the ship. Over the next several days, every member of the crew witnessed the faces appear and disappear, including the ship's captain. When he reported this to his supervisors after docking in New Orleans, it was suggested that he try to photograph the faces. And Captain Keith Tracy bought a camera, and the ship was soon underway again. Sure enough, the faces appeared, and Tracy took six pictures, then secured the camera in the ship's vault. The camera was not removed until it was taken to a commercial developer after docking in New York City. Five of the photos showed nothing unusual, but the sixth clearly showed what was said to be the faces of the two dead crewmen. No evidence of forgery or tampering of the film was ever discovered, and the faces stopped appearing after a new crew was brought aboard the Watertown. Matrixing or not?
Oh, that's very possibly matrixing. Just kind of a quick blurb on what we talked about last week. Matrixing is basically no different than when you look at a cloud and see a bunny rabbit in a cloud. It's just your brain kind of making up something that may appear similar to it. And, you know, the story is very interesting. That's great. And the way supposedly kind of the chain of evidence was handled, you know, the picture was taken, the camera was locked, it was taken to the developer, and, you know, and no sign of tampering was ever found. If this is all true, and the stories of what was said behind it was all true, then, you know, that these are very well maybe some, you know, excellent paranormal pictures. You know, I am just, you know, my expertise, I suppose, is what's been dubbed to me is, you know, paranormal photography. So, you know, I have a natural disbelief from anything that really doesn't come out of my camera. And I know very well I could make something like this and make up a very elaborate, cool, fancy story that evolves around it and pass it off, too. You know, I'm the type of person where I really kind of want to know, I want to see, you know, how that camera was done. You know, if what was said is true, then this is very good evidence. It's just also very possible that it could be matrixing, or it very well could be, I mean, that guy on the left almost looks like Hitler, you know, and it could be some picture kind of imprinted in on there. It kind of looks like Hitler and Albert Einstein in a ways. I don't know, what do you think?
Okay. My first thought was I didn't recognize anything on the left, but the right looked like George Washington. So definitely some matrixing or some going on there. Now that you mentioned Hitler, yeah, the one on the left does look like Hitler to me. So that's kind of weird. I don't think you're going to have much luck, not enough information to actually debunk any of these pictures or anything, but it's fun to look through. That some of these are the top ghost photos on the internet as far as people consider them. So it's just kind of weird. If you want to go to the next one, this one. This one is a guy I've gotten to know a little bit. In fact, I believe he's going to be a guest on our show in August, if we can work out all the details. The gentleman that took the picture is named Ike Clanton. He is a relative of the famous Clanton gang from the OK Corral. The gentleman in the picture is a friend of his wearing his gear, standing in Boot Hill Cemetery in Tombstone. Back in 96, he took this photo of his friend wearing his Western duds in the middle of the grave. And they both swear that nobody else was in sight when they made this picture. As you can see, there is a gentleman standing behind them. Sometime later, they tried to restage this picture with someone standing at the spot where the mystery man appears in the background. And Ike said it was impossible to take such a picture and not show the rear person's legs. He also said...
It almost appeared like the person's torso.
Yeah, he said he also wasn't so sure about Tombstone being haunted, but this photo made a believer out of him. And there's so much ghostly activity going on in Tombstone that he devoted a whole section of his website to it. There's also what they call the rock house down there, where if you go to this particular house and sit on the porch, eventually something will start throwing pebbles at you. The cemetery commissioner of Tombstone looked at this photo and said... that she would not allow Boot Hill Cemetery to be overgrown like this. So all this brush you see in front of these tombstones is not actually there. They keep this very well meticulously kept. If you go to the website on Tombstone, Arizona, there's a bunch of pictures of Boot Hill Cemetery there, and it is not overgrown like this, but it appears that way in this photo. So it almost looks like it's capturing maybe a residual of somewhere in another time period or something, because it has the growth of the undergrowth and all that stuff that isn't really there, as well as the person. And supposedly this person is carrying a knife, if you can see in the blow-up. Although one psychic had a rather interesting story, said that this is not actually a man, this is a woman. Dressed as a man, and she's carrying a carrot.
And she's carrying a carrot.
Yes, that she was on an upper balcony in Tombstone, getting ready to eat a carrot for her breakfast when she fell off the balcony and died. And that's when they discovered it was actually a woman instead of a man. So, I don't know. We got dueling psychics going on. One says it's a knife. One says it's a carrot. I don't know, but. It is a very intriguing photo. In fact, I've got it up as my my background for my desktop here. I've been staring at it for a couple days. I find Ike Clanton to be very trustworthy from what I've seen. I don't know him personally, but just doing my little bit of research behind the scenes here. So,
yeah,
I don't know. What's your take on this?
Well, it's not a very transparent figure, so... If it is a fake or staged shot, it's definitely not one using double imposing. It's more of one using a real person. Did you say what type of camera they were? They using a modern day camera or a old fashioned style camera?
It was 1996, and it did have an actual photo with it, so it wasn't a digital camera. It was a regular film camera. That much I know.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what model or anything.
No, that's fine. If it is fake, that's probably a real person there. Now, I would want to look at it a little bit more closely. I wish I could blow this up. They're like waist high. This person has no legs. If you compare them to, you know, the nearest tombstone, that nearest tombstone to them is shoulder high to them. So that's kind of odd in itself. I'm going to kind of ignore the whole overgrowth thing. I mean, the overgrowth is casting shadows. I don't know. So I don't know about, you know, whether maybe they caught them in between grass cuttings. I don't know. That's really good. I mean, you know, my biggest thing really is in a lot of these pictures is how well do you know and trust the person behind the camera. Obviously, the guy in a picture, he can't tell you whether or not somebody was there. He wasn't even looking. You know, he's looking in, you know, at the camera. So, you know, the person holding the camera is your key witness, you know. Is he somebody that is honestly, truly, 100% trustworthy, you know. Is he the type of person who's out there to try and make his name for having taken the greatest tombstone ghost picture, or is he just a humble, down-to-earth guy who could really care less about finding ghosts and just happen to stumble across it? You know, it's definitely not a double exposure. It's something solid that, or I don't want to say solid. If it's a spirit, it's obviously not solid. It's something that's there. It doesn't look, if it is a real person, I can't see any real trace of their legs. I can see the carrot or knife, whatever you want to call it. The whole psychic discussion is a discussion for a whole nother day. That's a really good picture. That's an excellent shot.
Well, hopefully in a few weeks you might have a chance to ask him yourself if I can get him to come on the show and discuss a few different things that's going on down there. I guess the Birdcage Theater is reputedly very haunted. And
oh, absolutely. I've heard a lot
about like that. So. Yeah, and this guy actually does an internet TV show every Tuesday night. If you go to hauntedsaloon.com, and he, you know, seems like he has a lot of fun and seems like a nice guy on there, but who knows?
Yeah.
Anyways, number 28. Midas floating around on the web, the man in the back seat. Well, the story behind this is that it's not a man. In 1959, Mabel Chinnery went to the cemetery to visit the grave of her mother, as any devoted daughter is apt to do. She took some photos of the gravesite and then turned and took this picture of her husband sitting alone in the car's passenger seat. The film was developed, and this came out. Somebody sitting in the back seat wearing glasses clear as day. Mrs. Chinnery swore that the back seat driver was none other than her own mother, whose gravesite she was standing next to when she took the picture. And it says here, a live husband and a deceased mother-in-law looking over his shoulder. There's a joke here. I just know it.
Very well could be, yeah.
Looking at the photo, says he's in the passenger seat, but I can almost see a steering wheel in front of him. I'm wondering if he's actually the driver, but that doesn't explain the person in the back seat. But
no, it doesn't. And for me, that almost looks like a man in the back seat. If she wants to call it a mother-in-law, then, you know, some mother-in-laws look like men.
Yeah. I've seen some ugly mother-in-laws before, so.
You never know. You know, this is where sometimes I got to kick myself and say, don't be so critical of everything. You know, cause, yeah, that's, I have a hard time. Boy, that's a great, I mean, I can't see it really being matrixing. For it to be matrixing, either there's usually a lot less definition, and you're kind of going, like that first one with the wave could have very well been matrixing. That last one obviously wasn't matrixing. This one here, there's, I think, a lot more facial details and the detail of what looks like a coat and an overcoat with a white shirt underneath it. The glowing eyes are kind of freaky.
I almost think those are glasses.
Right.
Reflection off glasses.
That's what I was just going to get to. If this was a spirit, if this was something not solid and not truly there, why would the light be reflecting off the glass of the lenses?
Hmm. Yep. That's my thought. I mean, this looks too good to be true, if you ask me.
Right. It really does. Now, the person who took the picture, or somebody who's a very strong proponent of this picture, is going to say, well, they're just glowing eyes of the spirit. Well, maybe they are. For me, they appear to be glasses, and if it isn't a solid figure that truly wasn't in the back seat, why is the light reflecting off the glasses? And that's my pretty much my critique to it right there. Is why is that light reflecting off? But, you know, if it's not truly there, the light shouldn't be reflecting off of it unless they're glowing eyes of a spirit.
This brings to mind a story of my own. I bought a new car. Well, not a new car, but new to me. I think it was a 1984 Oldsmobile 98. And the first time I drove it at night, I'm driving along, and all of a sudden I glanced over in the rearview mirror, and there's these two red eyes staring at me from the back seat. And I'm driving all by myself. So I'm like, what the heck? So I looked in the rearview mirror, and there's them two glowing eyes staring at me again. And this went on for like 20 minutes, you know, and they're just there, and I'm starting to get freaked out. I finally got back to town, and I got home, and I jumped out of the car. Of course, the light came on, and realized there's nothing there, and I climb in the back seat to investigate. And apparently 84 Oldsmobiles have this little thing on the ceiling which is tied in with your taillights. And as long as your taillight bulbs are working right, there's a red LED for each one of them. And so if one of your taillights goes out, one of these red LEDs goes out. So the whole way over, I was freaked out by this stupid two red LEDs that are telling me my taillights are working just fine. But I'll tell you what, freak you out when you're staring in the mirror and here's these two red eyes just constantly staring back at you.
Yeah, that's
all right.
Would be pretty freaky.
Oh, I'm telling you, it was freaky that night. All right. Number 29. This one's going to be a little hard to see, I think, until I explain what it is. Let's see. It says, remember how Archie Bunker liked his recliner so much that he never let anyone else sit in it? Well, old Archie doesn't have anything on Lord Cumbermere. After being ran over by a horse-drawn carriage, he died in 1891. A photographer set up a camera with its shutter open for 1 hour in the manor's library while the entire staff was off at Lord Cumbermere's funerals 4 miles away. When the plate was developed, the startling image of what looks to be a man's head and arm sitting in the chair was immediately noticed. Many of the staff said the image looked very much like the late Lord, and it happened to be sitting in Cumbermere's favorite chair in the library.
Oh, boy.
My first thought is, why would you set up a camera in the library for an hour with the shutter open during a guy's funeral unless you knew ahead of time you were going to catch something? I mean, what would even make if I was going to investigate somebody's haunted house, I don't think I'd do it during their funeral. I think I'd wait a while before I approached the family. But I don't know. It just kind of weird.
Very true. I agree with that. And let me go back. But I just quick. I got like 5 windows open on my computer here.
Yeah. So I got 7. And if the guy was there for an hour by himself, could he position himself in that chair and then get back out again without being caught on the film, but yet have his residual in the chair?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One, I highly doubt that shutter was open for an hour. Unless he had an extremely small aperture, very low film speed, I don't know. I mean, it obviously was an old camera. I think if you left the shutter open for an hour, this picture would be nothing but white, just light burnt into it. That's way too long during the day. You can't have a shutter open for an hour during the day. I'm sorry. That right there, for one, tells me there's something wrong. Two, I have done this a million times with my kid sitting in a chair, standing. You open the shutter for any amount of time. You have, when you open the shutter, or at any point while the shutter is open, you go and you have someone stand or sit in somewhere within the picture for a few seconds. If it's in 10-second shutter speed, if you have somebody stand, so I open the shutter for 10 seconds. For the first 5 seconds that shutter is open, I have somebody sit in that chair. And then after those 5 seconds, they say, okay, quick, get up and move out of the way. They move so quick that their movement doesn't even match. So basically, they're sitting in the chair for half the picture. They're going to look half of themselves in that chair, and you get a ghost image. They're transparent, just like that. I have no doubt in my mind that this is a fake. Especially given the way he described it, this is daytime, an hour-long shutter speed. He's exaggerating, obviously, and I honestly, really, truly think, even if he might have walked away from the camera and one of the butlers of the house or somebody walked through and said they wanted to sit down and take a rest. They sit down and take a rest for 30 seconds, a minute. If it's open for an hour, they could sit there for 5 minutes and still look just transparent.
Well, I guess this is how much I've learned from you just since we started doing the show, because originally I would have looked at this photo and just immediately accepted it. But I've gotten so I pick them apart a little more now than what I used to.
Yeah, and you got to. You have to. You got to be able to pick your pictures apart. That's key. Can't pick your pictures apart, then you're not really doing a good service. You have to be able to think a little bit outside the box and you know, ask yourself what could have caused this.
All right. Pile number 30. This is a pretty popular photo. I think this is one of the first ghost photos that I saw when I got on the internet. And the story behind this is Freddie Jackson was a mechanic in the Royal Air Force in World War I. His squadron served on board the HMS Diadalus. Freddie Jackson was killed in 1919 when an airplane propeller hit him. 2 days later, when the squadron assembled for a group photo, Freddie faithfully showed up, grinning behind the ear of a fellow comrade. Guess no one bothered to tell him that he was dead. His face was widely recognized in this photo by members of the squadron.
Normal person taking the picture, you know, I always kind of try and take a little more credibility to, you know, say a military person taking a picture for the squadron here.
I see the cropped one. I'm trying to find where the original is. I don't know if it's behind the cropped part or what, but I've searched and searched here, and trying to match up the hat. All right, I think it's the guy... the very back row, about four over from the left. I think that matches up with that, which would put this guy peeking around the corner in the very back row.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's one solid picture. You know, that's tough. This could be, this, you know, either somebody's there or it's a spirit. I'm going to leave it at that. Either somebody was actually standing there. Now, I don't know this person who was reportedly deceased and might be in the picture from a hole in a wall, so I can't tell you. Yeah, that's definitely the guy who was deceased standing behind him. I don't know. I don't know what he's supposed to look like.
Well, let me ask you this. Looking at how sharp everyone else's faces are in this picture, how would you make his picture look so, I don't want to say transparent or less sharp? How would you do that in a group photo like this without affecting anything else?
That is pretty sharp. I mean, that.
But I mean, compared to the guy in the front and all the rest of the people, he's considerably less sharp than what he is.
True. He would have to be. The only thing I would think, he'd have to be kind of a little bit more of a distance behind. So, I mean, this is either. I'd have to give this one some pretty decent credibility. Again, I don't know what Freddie Jackson is supposed to look like. So. You know, I kind of have to know what Freddy looks like, I guess, to really know for sure.
Yeah. So, I used to have this one as my desktop for a while. It was kind of a weird thing. All right, let's see here. I'm going to move on to file number 31. All right, file number 31 is called The Bedridden Boy. Photo was taken in 1999 at the historic Worley Bed and Breakfast Inn in Georgia. It wasn't until 4 years later that this photo, which seems to show a figure resting on a bed, was really given notice. It's thought that this might be the ghost of a young man who died in the house in the 1800s after being struck by a train.
Ooh, that's gotta hurt. Well, you gotta, it's sad when you can pick on the dead.
That's all right. They're gonna pick on us when we're gone. So
I'm sure they will. I give them full permission. There looks like there's an imprint in the bed, so that kind of gives me one hint that it might be fake. The light is really flooded. The light is very bright and kind of burnt in, and there's almost a lens flare of sorts. I almost wanted this was definitely taken with a time exposure, because the light is so bright and overpowering in the picture. And if it is taken with a time exposure, I want to say it's very possible. It's very possible that somebody could have been laying in that bed, and the shutter was open, got up, and walked towards the camera. And if you look to the right-hand side of this, the left-hand, you got the cropped version on the right and the non-cropped on the left. The left one kind of has that blurriness that kind of stands almost person-eye coming off the bed. That could very well be the person walking back towards the camera while the shutter's open, causing that. Or it could be because the shutter was open for such a long time that it created some sort of a little bit of a lens flare. And that bed is imprinted. There's something with weight laying in that bed.
And I just realized, as far as the archive goes, I forgot to say, I put the link to the photos in the chat room, but I forgot to actually say, go to hauntedamericaradio.com/photos and click on the Paranormal Photography album,
And all the photos are in there. And now that we're almost done, I remember to tell you that, to go to file number 31. Should have said that at the beginning. Oh, well. They can go back and look. All right. I guess we got file number 32, which is called the Newbie Church Monk.
That's a scary looking monk.
Supposedly, Reverend K.F. Lord took a picture of the altar at his church in North Yorkshire, England. And this is what came out. The picture and the negative are said to have been thoroughly examined by photographic experts, and they can't find any evidence that this was either a double exposure or artificially altered. The thing is calculated to be standing 9 feet tall, and no one's found any record of a monk that humongous ever being at Newbie Church. Who is it? What is it? Trick of light or something else? Either way, it's way too creepy not to mention.
Yes, that is creepy. I will say that. That's a creepy-looking spirit. You know, if these people came to me, I'd want to, they said they sent it to Kodak. Well, I want to see what Kodak sent back to them. Prove to me that you sent it to Kodak, because it looks like a double exposure. You know, you gotta prove to me you sent it to Kodak. I don't see how it can figure to be 9 feet tall either. You know, let's see, how big are those steps, Bryce?
I think they're figuring that they're standing on the bottom, where my thought is, if you were standing, you know, up on the second step or something with just a long robe on flowing all the way down to the floor, then, yeah, you're going to look 9 feet tall.
Yeah, I'm thinking, all right, how big are those steps that lead up to the altar? 6-8 inches at the most? Let's say 6 inches. You know, so that's six. I'm going to do the quick estimate here. Six. There's 1 foot. I'd put it maybe six, no taller than 6.5 feet. No, absolutely no taller than 7.
I don't know. They, according to them, it's 9 feet, so I don't know where they're figuring, they're getting their figures from, but.
I could be wrong, you know, at saying that those are steps, too. I'm just, you know, guessing.
All right. Say goodbye to Michael Jackson's ghost. He's got a book out of here a few minutes early.
Well, thank you for listening, Michael Jackson's ghost, and I hope all goes well with the wake and the funeral for you.
Oh, all right. File number 33. The Hampton Court Ghost.
Oh, that one is. I've heard of that one before I even liked ghost hunting.
Yeah, this one became fairly well known.
Isn't there a video that's supposed to go along with this?
I believe so, yeah. I think this is captured from a video. This one became fairly well known after it was released in December 2003. Hampton Court near London was one of Henry VIII's favorite hangouts, and it's because of him that Anne Boleyn is now a headless ghost roaming the Tower of London. A fire door inside the castle kept being opened when no one was supposed to be around. Guards checked the security camera's videotape and spotted this figure in period costume walking through the door. Castle personnel swear they don't know who did this, noting that they don't even have a costume that looks like this. Of course, this could be some prankster at work, or it could be a tourist in an overcoat. The actual footage of the specter opening the door is at the LEMUR Investigations website, which I'll stick in the chat room here.
in case anybody wants to go check out the video afterwards. Supposedly this came off the videotape, so...
Right.
What is it? It's anybody's guess, I guess.
Yeah, I've seen the videotape, so... You know, it is kind of transparent. It's a reputed haunted place. There's a security set up to, that kind of, it's not a camera set up for the purpose of, you know, tricking me or somebody into thinking it's a ghost. But, you know, I've seen this, and a lot of people have looked at this, and a lot of people well more qualified than me to debunk spirit pictures have looked at it and said it's true. As a picture alone, it could be something double exposed or just a person walking right out. You kind of have to take everything at face value. When you're not the person taking the picture, you got to take it at face value and whether or not you are the person taking the picture and if you trust the person behind it. Plain and simple.
My first thought is I'd like to see the rest of the video. I mean, does it come out the door and dissipate, or does it, you know, make a turn and walk away? Is it following the current walkway, or is it following a path that is no longer there, as in a residual haunting? You know, what's it doing after it leaves here is what I'd like to know.
I've seen the rest of the picture, I've seen the video, but it's been a while, and I honestly can't remember what it did. So... I'll have to look it up. I have enough windows open on my laptop that I don't need to open another one because then I'll be completely lost.
Yeah, I got eight of them now here, including the reminder that just popped up saying I have to go update WBTN schedule. Work is never done. All right, we got one more picture here, number 34. And this is probably one of the most infamous photo ever. The Brown Lady of Raymond Hall. It was taken in 1936 at Raymond Hall in North England by two photographers of Country Life magazine, which gives them a little credibility. Raymond Hall was long reputed to be haunted by the ghost of Lady Dorothy Townsend, who died in 1726. The ghost had been seen on many occasions throughout the years. When it was spotted descending the stairs by the Country Life photographers. So they actually saw it with their own eyes, and then they quickly took a snapshot. This is considered by many to be the most highly regarded and reputable photograph of a ghost yet made. And, of course, that's what we're here to do, is poke holes and debunk the most reputable ghost photo in history ever made. What do we see?
Well, that one is, it has kind of the transparency and invisibleness of a double exposure, but what are they double exposing? Because that is, it really doesn't look like a person. It really has almost like a skeleton look to it. It's glowing.
Yeah, I had to look close. If you look at the very top of the photo, if you tilt your head to the right, I can actually see a face which looks like it's got its head tilted. But it almost looks like a guy's face to me, or like you said, maybe even a skeleton. But other than that, I can't really make out much of anything for features, and you can see through it.
That one's really good. I like that picture. I'd have to definitely give that one some pretty decent credibility.
Now that I've just noticed the face at the top, I've never noticed that before. I like to see what the two photographers looked like, and just to see if it looks like any of their faces.
Yeah, and that's true, too,
Having two photographers. You know, it don't take two of them to hold. So, what was the
same
guy
that's
you
very
time?
True. Yeah, it definitely doesn't take two photographers, so you're right. It's very likely that it could be a, one of them standing there while the other one pretends to be a ghost.
Yeah. That is my first thought at looking at it through these more skeptical eyes. I photo or take of his 35 that we spoke about the weeks back. That one just covers everything. So that one's hard to debunk.
Yeah. But I must say I the last minute of what you said I couldn't hear a word of it because I don't know why, but I can hardly understand what you're saying. You're breaking up. Now I don't really hear much of anything. All right, am I still there? Are you still there? Hello? Anybody? Hello? Did you bring your... Never mind, I see him. Hello?
Jeez. Hello.
Hey, we're back in time just for the last minute.
Yeah, I got 25 seconds left. Say goodbye, Josh.
All right, well, thank you everybody for listening. If you stuck through our 5 minutes of dead air, or you could have been hearing me talking to my daughters. I don't know. If not, you know that my daughter's going to take a shower and not going to wear her goggles in it. If not... Then everybody, thank you for listening. We look forward to hearing you again, and tell all your friends about the show, and continue to listen, and thank you. And happy birthday, Alex. Went through the whole show without saying it.
That's all right. I didn't want to be reminded anyways.
Oh, I have to remind you eventually.
Next week on the show, we're already off the air, but this is for the archiving people. Next week on the show, second hour, Dave Schrader from Darkness on the Edge of Town will be here with us, and I don't know what we're going to do the first hour. I'll leave that up to you.
All righty.
And let me play some music here just to signify some sort of an ending to this this chaos we call a radio show.
That was not chaotic. No, we went in with a rough game and came out with a good show.
There we did. All right. I'll see you next week.
All right, we'll be in touch, everybody.
I can do a ghost.